I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. This year, there's 8 contested seats on the Kansas City Council. We'll sit down with all 16 candidates to learn about their plans to address crime, affordable housing, development, and more. We're starting today with the candidates from the 4th District seeking to fill Julie Justice's old seat. We'll find out how their experience prepares them to represent Kansas City from nearly Brookside to River Market. Then it was President Calvin Coolidge who signed the country's most restrictive immigration law back in 1924. We'll look at the so-called science that policymakers use to close U.S. borders to Italians and European Jews. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. With Julie Justice running for mayor of Kansas City, her 4th district seat on the city council is up for grabs. The district runs from the River Market through Westport and the Plaza south to about 58th Street. Now the first in a series of conversation with the candidates for the city council will focus on the 4th district, and we'll be talking about housing and incentives for developers and crime and a whole lot more. With us are the two candidates. Eric Bunch helps run a nonprofit and is a sidewalk advocate. Eric, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
Jeff Jolly is here. He's a Kansas City firefighter and a longtime aide to Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver. Jeff, good morning to you.
Good to see you.
Before we get into the issues, Jeff, just tell us about yourself a little bit. Give us the Jeff Jolly bio here.
Well, I was born and raised here in Kansas City. Grew up just a few blocks away from where we are today. Ultimately went off to college and law school, and when I was in law school, 9/11 happened, and so that changed the trajectory of my life. Well, ultimately, I saw all these people, walking away from their jobs to go to New York to help, and so I became a firefighter while I was in law school. And when I came back to Kansas City, started working for the congressman, and, missed the opportunity to give back as a firefighter. And so I joined the Kansas City Fire Department and juggled both jobs working. So I've trained attorney, but a firefighter at heart.
Eric Bunch.
Yeah. You already mentioned that I help run a nonprofit. I co-founded the organization Bike Walk KC not quite 10 years ago. I've been living here back in Kansas City for about 10 years. I went to college, William Jewell College up in Liberty. My wife and I live not far from here in Midtown with our 5-year-old son and twin 2-year-olds, and so we have built a nice walkable life. My wife works at the Nelson Atkins. I work at Bike Walk KC. Our jobs are close, our schools are close, and that's something that's really important to us as a family. And it's something that we feel is important to a community. We've been fortunate to meet a lot of our neighbors, a lot of our friends, because of that sort of tight-knit community that Kansas City, particularly the 4th District, really is.
I can't help but wonder why you guys want the job. It's a lot of work, Jeff.
Well, I think there's a lot of opportunity. I mean, Kansas City has been experiencing tremendous growth and momentum and, a lot of civic pride right now. And I think I felt like there was an opportunity as somebody who had worked both at the federal level and at the city level to bring a unique perspective to how we address kind of neighborhood issues and how we, break down some barriers, in city government. And so I'm excited about the opportunity. I think you saw through the primary election the number of people running for mayor and city council. There's a lot of excitement in the city.
Mm-hmm. Eric?
Yeah, likewise. The momentum here is certainly palpable. I think the energy is great. We've seen some pretty tremendous growth over the last 8 years, 10 years. It's a different city than the one I moved back to 10 years ago, and that's exciting. And I wanted to be a part of that, and I was a part of that when we started Bike Walk KC. We realized that as a city, we needed to make some progress on walkability and transit access and accessibility for those with disabilities. And so we felt that some of those things were getting left behind in this momentum, as well as bigger picture things like affordable housing policy and things of that nature. We've got to tackle some big issues while making sure that we keep the momentum going. We can't let the momentum die. We've got to really transition that into really positive things to make a city that works well for the people.
So what are the one issue that you want to see addressed during a 4-year term on the city council? Eric, I'll begin with you. What are you most determined to work on here?
I would say the biggest thing is working at the intersection of housing and transportation, no pun intended. But, you know, housing and transportation are two critically important things that we, I think, have really missed the boat on in some ways. I think there's still time. There's still an opportunity, certainly a window of opportunity to implement some policy that works well in terms of housing. Bottom line is we're seeing the quality of life improve in Kansas City. I think that's a good thing. I think that we have to keep that.
When you say transportation, what are you talking about?
In terms of transportation, I think that we need to make sure that as we expand public transit, that housing remains affordable along those public transit lines. That's something that's critical. And the danger is that the very thing that our most vulnerable citizens rely on in that case, public transportation, is often the vehicle, quite literally the vehicle, that can create the displacement that I think we're in danger of seeing here. And so how do we make that balance? How do we continue to improve the quality of life while ensuring that our folks don't have to move away from a neighborhood that really works for them, that's right next to public transit? And so that's what I mean by the intersection of transportation and housing.
Jeff Jolly, how about you? What's the one issue you're determined to focus on during a council term?
Well, I think the one issue has to be that we need to make sure that we're creating a city that's more responsive to the citizens. So, making sure that we invest smartly and efficiently and effectively in basic city services, make sure that we do what we need to do, that we've promised voters, we're going to take these certain actions, whether it's on infrastructure or, the overflow control plan or other, projects that we need to deliver. I think citizens, when I'm out talking to residents, knocking on doors and at community forums, they're getting tired of kind of being overpromised and then underdelivered. And, mm-hmm. Infrastructure, is one of those that repeatedly the Citizen Satisfaction Survey has shown to be 25% satisfied, in our city, and we have got to do a better job of addressing what citizens care about.
What's the present city council been good at, Eric, and where does it fall in short?
I think that the current city council and mayor have done a good job of taking on some really big projects, and I think that things like the airport, of course, that's had some hiccups, and I think that would be one of the criticisms that I have. We took a really huge infrastructure project, and treated it as if it was building a simple thing like a new sidewalk down the street, and I think that was partly because it was right in the middle of campaign season, and so I think that the current city council has let a little bit of that seep into their policymaking. I think that's problematic. But overall, I think that we've continued to push the envelope on some of these big policy issues like affordable housing, like transportation. But bottom line is we've got to continue to keep that momentum going without letting politics get in the way. So I think that's an area that we could improve on.
Jeff?
Well, I think the city council has done a good job in a number of different areas. Like all city councils, there's areas where the new council will probably take a different approach and different mm-hmm. priorities. Ultimately, half the council is going to be new members. And so I think it's important for us as we go in to identify kind of what are the priorities for the new council and the new mayor, whether that's Councilwoman Justice or Councilman Lucas. I look forward to working with either one of them, if elected, and we're going to proceed, as a council.
Now, you guys are running for the 4th District Council seat. A lot of people live in the 4th District because they think it's removed from the issue of crime by and large. Crime, obviously a big issue in this campaign, much talked about. What's the way forward? The homicide rate, the violent crime rate in this community, still very high. How do you address it, Jeff?
Well, Steve, this is one of the most complicated issues, one that, you've spent many segments on already,
yep.
And we could do an entire show on. But, crime does impact. Keep in mind, the 4th District also includes the historic Northeast, north of the Independence Avenue, as well as some of our friends in the Northland, off North Oak, Briarcliff area, Midtown. Crime happens everywhere. I think that we have to take a holistic approach. One, we need to make sure that we connect the dots. We also need to understand that a lot of violent crime is a health issue in my mind. Johns Hopkins recently did a study about youth violence in particular and focused on if we can help get young people out of some of the situations, get them into better health circumstances, they are less likely to commit crime. But it's going to be a community-wide effort with schools, with our health department, with our law enforcement agencies. There's no silver bullet that's going to solve this issue.
Do you want to hire more police officers?
I think we need to sit down with the police department and see what they need. Mm-hmm. And whether that's more police officers or whether that's getting some additional civilians into police headquarters so more of their officers can get on the street. I think more social workers would be a good start. I think a lot of our crimes are mental health-based.
You know, we just did a show, Jeff, on Oakland's successful efforts to lower its violent crime rate. One theme that emerged in that conversation was the need to invest more heavily in social services, ensure that the leaders of different initiatives are coordinating their efforts. I mean, is it time to pass an initiative to spend more dollars on wraparound services for those who are prone to violence?
I don't, you know, I'd have to look at the survey. I mean, I think it's time for us to evaluate whether we're taking the right approach. And in that regard, I mean, you know, we've had some success in different areas with different approaches over the years. And then for 2 or 3 years, we see a reduction in crime. We were very pleased last year in Northeast not to have any homicides with a real focus on crime prevention there. But then this year we've already had at least one or two, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hit and miss. And I think, you know, we need to determine how are we going to deal with it. I also think we need to engage the business community to make sure that they understand that crime takes away from everybody. Even if you're not personally impacted, as a community, we are impacted.
Right.
And we need to start saying, this is something we have to address along with our education programs, you know, to make sure that we're the city that we all want it to be.
Eric Bunch, what do you want to do when it comes to crime in this community?
I think that we have to face the reality that we're dealing with decades of disinvestment. We're dealing with, I mean, honestly, centuries of institutionalized racism that have led to the position, the current situation. And until we start to address the root causes of, you know, disparity after disparity, be it wealth, public health disparities, be it unemployment, unemployment disparities, public investment disparities, until we start to really address those and tackle them head on, we're going to continue to see that cycle up and down, up and down. There are certainly things we can do in the short term. I would say that we've got to put more social workers in places where people can access good care. We have to explore ideas like crime prevention through environmental design, which is, you know, it encourages walkability. It encourages more eyes on the street and more community policing through design. But those are things that we can do in the short term. But in the long term, we have to tackle those big, huge disparities and really start to address the centuries of racism that have existed here in this community.
Do you want to hire more police officers?
I don't think that that's the exact right approach. I think that, you know, we've continued to see the budget for the police department increase year after year, and we've seen the homicide rate climb over the last several years. And mm-hmm. Hiring more police and increasing the budget, the police and fire budget combined still takes up 76% of the general fund. And
yeah.
I think we have to be aware of that, and we have to, you know, take stock in what's working and what's not working.
You know, let's turn to a different topic. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking with the two candidates for the 4th District City Council seat in Kansas City, Jeff Jolly and Eric Bunch. Incentives for developers, Eric, is there still a place for tax breaks for developers focused on downtown projects? Or has the time come to end downtown incentives in a push to focus more on the east side?
I think that type of black and white thinking maybe is the wrong approach, you know, to say downtown absolutely no or downtown absolutely yes. I think that it has to be a sliding scale, so to speak, that, you know, if projects are needed, so if we have a disparity or if we have a shortfall in housing, particularly affordable housing in downtown where we have a lot of jobs, where we have good access to public transportation, amenities, you know, then maybe we still need to be building more affordable housing in downtown. But certainly we need to create a checklist of all the things that we want new development to to accomplish, mm-hmm. be it build more workforce, affordable housing, build, reinvest in those disinvested communities that have not seen this type of redevelopment for so long, but score it based on a variety of long-term goals for the city.
You know, Eric, there's a question on the ballot in June when you'll be on the ballot that would cap the amount of property tax abatements available to assist developers down to 50% of what's allowed by state law. Good idea?
No, I think it's a bad idea, and it goes beyond just abatements. It's across the board, 50% cap in incentives, and I think that ties the city's hands in what we can do to lure development into places where, particularly economically distressed areas, where 50% may not be enough of an incentive to make sure redevelopment happens.
How do we lure development east of Troost? I mean, the city council's tried for years, and very mixed record at best.
Well, I think part of that reason is that we're still challenged to see, for developers to see a return, and I think that we have to kind of reframe the opportunity as we need to reinvest in communities, not just see a financial return on that investment. We have to make sure that we're doing work with the community and for the community. And mm-hmm. and I think that starts with smaller scale development. Let's work with the community who's there already to reinvest in things like, the $9,000 or $10,000 land bank owned properties that are sitting vacant that the city can't maintain. Mm-hmm. How can we package those for smaller, medium-sized developers who are currently shut out? And I think we also have to look at property tax freezes, partly because that can help incentivize some development. But as the development occurs, how do we protect the people who are already living there, maybe owning homes on a fixed income?
So I think targeted property tax freezes would be something you'd be open to.
I think that's something. Yeah, absolutely. I think that we have to look at all of the options because removing blight should be a big concern for us. It should be a top priority for us in the community, because if we're not seeing reinvestment, we're going to continue to see the violent crime go up. We're going to continue to see those disparities that I spoke of earlier.
Jeff Jolly, is there still a place for tax breaks in connection with downtown projects or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think where appropriate, we need to continue. Downtown has created additional jobs, additional revenue as a result of, residents moving in. You've seen the growth of downtown. It's significantly different mm-hmm. than as a child when my mother used to work down there and we'd go down late at night, we'd be the only car on the street. Downtown's a very different place now. And so, we need to maintain that momentum, but we need to make sure, I understand why the petitioners, are pushing this 50%, which I'm not supportive of. Many of them are friends, but they're doing it because they feel like that City Hall wasn't listening to them, mm-hmm. that they feel like City Hall continued to approve tax abatements for projects that didn't necessarily need them. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, we have to give those taxing jurisdictions, the ones that are most impacted, the schools, our community health centers, our community colleges, the library, a bigger voice, a bigger seat at the table in deciding whether or not an incentive package should be approved or not. But limiting ourselves to an arbitrary cap of 50% isn't the right approach.
How do you get more development east of Troost?
Well, I think ultimately developers are going to go where they see the biggest opportunity for profit. So one of my experiences in the congressional office was people would come to our office regularly and say, can we get the federal government to pay for 100% of a project? And we'd say, well, no, that's not how that grant project works.
Yeah.
I think as the city starts to say, we're not going to be able to approve all of these. I mean, I understand why the developers are going to areas where it's more lucrative. But ultimately, if we start saying, well, as a community, we want to see more development east of town. And so we're more likely to incentivize a project over here than we are, on the west side. I think you will see those developers make the choice, to move east.
The candidates for the 4th District Council seat, now held by Jolie Justice, are my guests, Eric Bunch and Jeff Jolly. Another hot issue, affordable housing. One big push by the current City Council has been to create a $75 million housing trust fund. Problem is, Eric, it's not funded. How should that happen?
You got
$75 million sitting around.
I certainly don't. I wish I did have $75 million. And I think we have to be honest that $75 million probably isn't even enough to address the need. When we're talking about housing our most vulnerable citizens, $75 million probably isn't enough. So there's a question of where does it come from and what do we use it for? Where does it come from? I think that we need. I think that that's another question about incentives. You know, if do we offer more incentives if there's a guarantee that we're going to produce pilots, payment in lieu of taxes in some cases to fund this.
You know, Scott Wagner, the current city councilman, the mayor pro tem, offered an idea to raise property taxes in a small amount to help fund this fund, the $75 million fund. Would you back that?
No, I don't think so, because then we're increasing property taxes in many cases for the very people who are most vulnerable from being displaced because of rising property taxes. So I think that's the wrong approach. In the same way that using sales taxes in so many cases.
So where do you go to get the money to fund affordable housing projects?
Let's look at what some of the other cities have done. You know, we're seeing linkage fees in the case when there's a major development happening that's bringing tons of new jobs to a downtown, for example, that creates a strain on the housing market. When we were chasing Amazon a few years ago, that if we had landed Amazon headquarters, we would have had a really serious housing shortage on our hands. Right. And so in those cases, when we do lure those businesses in, we probably should be looking at things like linkage fees, where we tie a fee to that particular development to fund housing. So that goes directly into that housing fund. In the case when we're not
putting affordable units. Enough money to get you what you need?
I think it has to be a mix of things. Probably not, but it's a start. Mm-hmm. Another start would be those pilots, as I mentioned earlier. So if we are incentivizing a development in downtown, then maybe it should be paying one of those pilots into the housing fund. So there are no simple answers, and I think it's going to take multiple sources of funds to make it happen, but I think we're really looking at a much bigger problem than $75 million, and I think we really have to get real about how we fund that trust fund.
Jeff Jolly, do you have $75 million to toss into that housing trust fund?
No, I loaned it to you the other day.
Yeah. So it's on me, right?
Yeah, it's on you.
Yeah.
No, I mean, unfortunately, in this community, we have a lot more need than we have available resources, and so this is an issue like all others that we're going to have to address through kind of the annual budget process. One of the concerns I have is that projects tend to come up kind of outside that process, and individually everything looks great. I mean, but much like people have to do at home, we have to set aside budgets. We have to prioritize, and we have to determine what as a community, where do we want to invest our money. Affordable housing has certainly got to be near the top of the list there. But where that money comes from, I think we're going to have to sit down, take a hard look with the finance team and the city manager.
How about Councilman Wagner's idea to raise property taxes to help fund a public housing trust fund, Jeff?
I mean, I think that's worth exploring. I mean, property tax is less regressive than a sales tax. It's one option that we might explore.
How about linkage fees that your opponent just suggested?
I'm not sure that that's going to generate the type of revenue we need.
Okay. Voters in this town just rejected a sales tax increase for early childhood education. Does the city need to take another crack at it in the next year or two?
No. I think the city needs to support our school districts. And we can do, we can help them in a variety of ways by making sure that we've created an infrastructure around schools. We create safe routes to schools for children to get to, that we, lower the crime around schools.
But how about early childhood education?
Look, my wife's a public school teacher here in Kansas City, and both my girls go to the Kansas City School District. And so, I fully support the people that we train and we pay and we, task with educating our children in this community. And the school districts have made very clear they don't need city government coming in and stepping on their toes.
But all kinds of experts say that pre-K education is the wave of the future. That's where you got to be.
Well, I think that there's some research to indicate that that's the case, but there's also some that would say that over the long term, there's a lot of other factors that go into
right.
a child's development and social skills. And so, ultimately, the Kansas City School District indicated that they were willing to add additional seats. They could have added additional seats for $3 million.
Mm-hmm.
They lose $30 million, $35 million every year in tax abatements. So, I think there are ways for us to support the school districts without us. Until we start getting the things that we need to do right, let's focus on the city services first.
Eric Bunch, what about pre-K education? Is that on your agenda if you become a member of the city council?
Yeah, it is. And it doesn't necessarily mean that the end result is something that is an initiative led by city council. But I do think that we have to focus on it. We've seen the results in places like D.C. and a similar program that was proposed here in Denver. And we've seen some major results from it. And, you know, my son's in kindergarten, and I've seen the disparities between the kids who got a high quality pre-K education, those who didn't. And the disparities are staggering.
So you want to see a program in place?
I think we do need to have a program in place. The voter spoke. You know, there's no better public opinion poll than a ballot initiative. And so they spoke. And I think what they said was that we've got to have the school districts involved and on board.
So you'd be willing to take another crack at it with the school districts being more involved.
Yeah, and I don't know what the funding mechanism necessary is. I don't even know what the governance structure is. But what I do know is that it's important, and it's important for the sake of our future. It's important for tackling, again, back to all those disparities I spoke of earlier. Early childhood education is a proven way to start to tackle those things, and I think we've got to work on it. So I definitely would make it a priority of mine.
We're going to leave our conversation right there. That was the voice of Eric Bunch, candidate for the 4th District City Council seat in Kansas City. He's joined by his opponent, Jeff Jolly, also a candidate for the 4th District seat. Gentlemen, thanks for a good conversation. Appreciate it, and good luck out there, okay?
Thanks, Steve. Good to
Thank
be
you,
here.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the most restrictive immigration policy this country ever adopted. It was back in the 1920s. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, a move to bring trash service in-house for all Kansas City residents is projected to save the city $20 million over 10 years. Hear more about that plan and other previous conversations. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, why is the American healthcare system so expensive, and is there anything the U.S. government can do about it? We'll hear perspectives from scholars at the libertarian-leaning Cato Institute. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, there was a time in this country when so-called scientists worked with white supremacist policymakers to create an immigration policy that excluded would-be immigrants deemed inferior to white Christians. President Coolidge signed the Johnson-Reed Act back in 1924, which was this country's most restrictive immigration law ever. It set quotas for various foreign nations. That formula intentionally excluded certain countries and took aim at Italians and Eastern European Jews. The policy effectively stranded certain people desperate to leave their home countries because of persecution and death. Yes, all this carries with it a ring of modern-day familiarity. Daniel Okrent chronicles this harrowing tale in a new book, The Guarded Gate: Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Daniel Okrent was the first public editor of the New York Times, editor-at-large of Time, Inc., and managing editor of Life magazine. He worked in book publishing as an editor at Knopf and Viking and was editor-in-chief of General Books at Harcourt Brace. He joins us now from NPR Studios in New York. Daniel, good morning.
How are you, Steve? Nice to be here.
You know, after World War II, at the Nuremberg trial, some of the Nazis pointed to, of all places, America as the source of their supposedly scientific theories for exterminating the Jews. Did those statements have any foundation?
Well, extermination, no. I don't think that arose from any American influence. but classifying Jews as a racial group as being inferior intellectually, morally, and otherwise to Aryans, that does have roots in America, in the eugenics movement that blossomed in America around 1905 to 1910, and by 1920 was almost universally accepted as a form of science. It became known later as scientific racism, but at the time it was simply science. And at the Nuremberg trials, those who defended themselves said, we weren't doing these things on our own. They didn't say we were following orders. They say we were following Americans, and to a degree they were right.
You know, this push towards ostracizing certain peoples, you just mentioned the timeline here a little bit. It began in the late 19th century, continued through the early decades of the 20th century. I'm wondering why then? What was happening that caused this deep interest in eugenics at that time?
Well, there are a variety of reasons. I think that first we have to understand that the American engagement with immigrants, it's like a sine wave that goes through American history. As far back as 1753, Benjamin Franklin was saying, keep the Germans out of Pennsylvania. Yes. They're destroying our culture and our language. And then later it was freedom, and then the Irish came, no, let's keep them out. And then we need labor during Civil War, so let's bring them in. And this vibrates back and forth. It was in the 1890s that this particular anti-immigrant movement began. And I think that it was simply a response to the sheer numbers that beginning around 1885, 1890, suddenly there were hundreds of thousands of people coming from Europe to the U.S., to U.S. ports, and coming into the country. This happened for a variety of reasons, but not least because finally there was a railroad network in Europe that would enable people who wanted to leave to get to the ports.
So the similarities to today, unmistakable here.
Absolutely. People who are fleeing lives that they know can be improved in another place. Back then, the incredible forms of peonage and mistreatment of farm workers in southern Italy and the poverty of the region impelled many hundreds of thousands to want to leave. In Eastern Europe, in the so-called Pale of Settlement, under the Russian Empire, where the Jews were forced to settle, where they were limited in their educational opportunities, where they were not allowed to practice certain professions, where there was also great poverty, they had reason to flee. And finally, the combination of the rail system and the transatlantic steamships made it possible.
You know, the result of all of this was this law called the Johnson-Reed Act that came into place, signed by the president in 1924. The law cut immigration of Eastern European Jews by more than 90% and Italians and other Southern Europeans by 99%, but it expanded opportunities for those from Northwest Europe. So no question here that this movement was a movement of significant consequence.
Absolutely. When the first restriction laws were proposed in 1895 by Senator Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts, he very specifically said, and he used these words in his speech on the Senate floor, this will keep out people from Russia and from Italy and from Greece and from Armenia and the other countries that he wished to exclude. It will not affect immigrants from the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, from Germany, from the Scandinavian countries. And in fact, by the time they got around to passing a law that a president would sign, they had built that into it, the discrimination between the so-called Nordic countries of Northwestern Europe and the looked-down-upon countries of the South and East.
You know, at first, this struck me as interesting. This idea of eugenics or improving the human species through reproduction wasn't based on race per se. So what was it based on?
Well, it all comes out of the Darwinian Revolution. You know, in 1859, Darwin publishes Origin of the Species. And if there was one key thing that was immediately absorbed into the culture and particularly into the scientific world, it's that the notion of the prevailing notion of the origin of mankind was Adam and Eve. And once evolution establishes that it was not Adam and Eve, once it established that we are not all brothers and sisters, we are not related to each other, then it introduces racial hierarchy and racial hatred, the feeling of superiority over someone else. Now, the eugenicists were led by a man named Francis Galton, who in fact coined the word. He was a cousin of Darwin's, and he began thinking about improving the nature of the population. So one of his grandiose ideas was to find the 5,000 best young people in England, match them up in arranged marriages, and presided over in one mass marriage in Westminster Abbey, presided over by Queen Victoria, and then they would be paid a certain stipend every year so they wouldn't have to work. They could just get to work making better babies for a better Britain. But by the time this leaps across the Atlantic, it begins to change, and there's what comes to be called negative eugenics. It's not just let's improve the people by mating the best with the best, but let's stop the reproduction of the worst. And that was something that applied not only to those who were already here, you know, to people who were deemed, to use the term of the time, feeble-minded, for instance, but to the immigrants. And the first notion was, we will stop these immigrants at the gate and determine one by one. You know, is this, we don't want the epileptic, we don't want the deaf, we don't want the blind, we don't want the feeble-minded. But then everything changes in 1916. A book is published called The Passing of the Great Race by a very wealthy New Yorker, founder of the Bronx Zoo, named Madison Grant, and right. he applies those individual principles to racial and ethnic groups.
Wow. Daniel Okrent is my guest. His new book, it's an acclaimed new book, The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Well, let's talk about Madison Grant, who, again, is cited for mixing eugenics with anti-immigrant xenophobia here. Who was he exactly?
So Grant was from the heir to two very wealthy New York landowning families. He did have an education abroad first, was sent to Dresden for his education, and then at Yale and Columbia Law School. But he never really practiced law. He was so wealthy he didn't need to. His real passion, his motivating passion in the beginning of his public life and throughout his public life was conservation, and he was considered the leading environmentalist in the country. Mm. He was responsible, for instance, for saving the redwoods of California and their redwood forests named after him with wow. plaques. Without Madison Grant, this wouldn't have happened. But at the same time, he wanted to keep out immigrants from countries he deemed inferior. And this was all of a piece. He wanted to preserve the American landscape, and he wanted to preserve what he considered the American bloodstream and keep that to peoples that he called the Nordics, the people from Northern and Western Europe. And there's one particular passage in his book that strikes me as kind of the essence of what he was up to. He writes that it's well known, even though it wasn't well known, that if you match a superior being mm-hmm. to a lesser being, a lesser racial group, that the progeny will revert to the lower form. Therefore, he said, a marriage between a Nordic and an Alpine, the Alpines were okay, would yield an Alpine. A marriage between an Alpine and a lowly Mediterranean would yield a Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And he said, the marriage between any of the three European groups and a Jew will produce a Jew. And this was sort of the essence of this view of a hierarchy of racial or ethnic value. And because eugenics had already been booming at the more simplified individual levels, it caught on very, very quickly. The idea that this could be applied to these immigrants that we want to keep out of the country.
So was it pseudoscience or was it base racism here?
I think this was a case of some science that had a little bit of plausibility. And we know that if a tall person marries a tall person, their kids are likely to be tall. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit of a basis of genetic science in it. It was even before the word genes and genetic had been coined. But what had been happening since Henry Cabot Lodge introduced his bill in 1895, four times Congress passed restriction laws and four times presidents vetoed them. And the people who were running the anti-immigration movement, the ones who were most motivated, they needed something else. Then along comes this guy Grant with this thing that was not science, that was fantasy on his part, and he brings the two movements together. So now we have a reason. It's not racial. It's not racism that is making us want to keep Italians out. It's because of science. They're inferior.
Yeah. Another key figure here, and this will surprise a few people out there, a guy named Maxwell Perkins, who's been credited for having discovered F. Scott Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Thomas Wolfe. Tell us about his beliefs.
This was a real heartbreaker for me because
I've
revered Maxwell Perkins. I began my career in the book publishing business as an editor, and everything I knew about him was positive. Well-loved by his friends, published great books, absolutely devoted to the finest principles. But he also published many of, if not most of, the books of scientific racism. He was handed Madison Grant's book by his boss. But from that day forward, he edited Grant and Lothrop Stoddard, another writer who wrote seven books that all made the case for white world supremacy, was his term. And Perkins even edited a new book by Grant in 1933, by which time all these theories had been discredited and the Nazis had established themselves in Germany. So does it mean that Maxwell Perkins was himself a bigot? No, not necessarily. But he definitely promoted the works of bigots.
You know, one thing to underscore, and you've mentioned this already, but and this was this idea that the extent to which progressives in the country embrace these ideas, Maxwell Perkins, President Theodore Roosevelt, no less, you already mentioned Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, who was a prime mover here on this front. I mean, the Northeastern Blue Bloods were solidly behind this kind of thinking.
Right. And the progressives, interestingly, made common cause with the arch conservatives. Grant was an arch conservative. But on the other side, one of the main characters in my book is a fascinating guy named Joseph Lee, who was the first citizen of Boston, a fabulously wealthy man, incredibly philanthropic, supported every possible good cause that you could think of. As chairman of the Boston School Committee, he brought doctors into the schools. He wanted to keep the schools open at night so immigrants could learn English. He founded the Massachusetts Civic League, which passed all sorts of good government laws. But at the same time, he was the single primary financier behind the entire anti-immigration movement for more than 30 years. And this in public, you know, this model citizen, in private, in his letters, he writes such things that he explains to one friend that he feels that he has to finance this movement because otherwise we will become a Dago nation. He says at another point that to another correspondent, soon Europe will be drained of all its Jews. To its benefit, no doubt, but not to ours. And this kind of, it beggars belief. It doesn't seem to fit.
And along those lines, Teddy Roosevelt, enshrined on Mount Rushmore, no less, once said this. He said, someday we will realize that the prime duty, the inescapable duty of the good citizen of the right type is to leave his or her blood behind him in the world, and that we have no business to permit the perpetuation of citizens of the wrong type. I mean, wow.
It's pretty chilling. Teddy Roosevelt was a great proponent of an idea called race suicide, and he saw that the immigrants particularly were multiplying at a faster rate. They had more children than the well-established Americans. Interestingly, in the time, these people called themselves Native Americans. These were the a different kind of Native American than we perceive today. But those who had come over from England in the 17th century, they called themselves Native Americans, England and other northern countries. So Roosevelt pushed this idea that white Americans, well-established family that didn't have at least five children wasn't doing its patriotic part because the reproduction in the ghettos and the slums was so much greater.
I want to, again, continue this line of thinking, give our readers a sense of the mindset of those times. A guy named Charles Davenport, director of the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory and an increasingly influential figure at the time, wrote this in 1911. He said, unless conditions change of themselves or are radically changed, the population of the United States will, on account of the great influx of blood from southeastern Europe, rapidly become darker in pigmentation, smaller in stature, more mercurial, more attached to music and art, more given to crimes of rape and sex immorality, and less given to burglary, drunkenness, and vagary than were the original English settlers. I mean, that's pretty specific.
I like the idea that he says that they'll be more inclined toward music and art.
Yeah, you joke about it. Yeah, right.
It was this crazy idea that you could use the same basic principles of Mendelian genetics to any aspect of the human being's genetic makeup. So it wasn't just a matter of an on and off switch of a single unit characteristic. You know, one gene controls colorblindness, for instance. Mm-hmm. But intelligence or morality, it's impossible to make that kind of sorting and classification. Yet they were so in love, and Davenport's a really interesting character. He was so in love in what he believed was scientifically correct, and he was himself a fine scientist, an important animal geneticist, so in love with it that he took it to crazy, crazy lengths. And then finally, influenced by Madison Grant, he writes a letter to Grant in 1920, a very telling letter. Can we build a wall high enough to keep these people out? He was speaking metaphorically, but it's kind of stayed with us 100 years later.
So the connection then between the 1924 law that President Coolidge signed and this idea that it prevented scores of Jews who wound up dying during the Holocaust from ever immigrating to this country, what is that connection? Make that clear for us.
Well, first, it's hundreds of thousands, if not millions. the Albert Johnson, the congressman who wrote the Johnson-Reed Act, figured near the end of his life that 18 million Eastern and Southern Europeans did not come to America because of that law. Now, maybe it was 9 million, maybe it was 4.5 million, but we know it was many hundreds of thousands, if not millions. The connection that I think you can make to today is the notion of sorting people by nationality. And our current administration first did it by sorting out those from Muslim nations, not individual Muslims who were terrorists or who wanted to impose Sharia law or whatever the other things that he feared, but everyone from Yemen, everyone from Syria. And I think that we're seeing a similar version of that, not quite as extreme at the border today. It's not keep out the Honduran who is not going to be good for our culture, but keep out Hondurans, all those people who are coming to the border. The use of phrases like they are murderers and rapists, that's not talking about individuals. That's not talking about the criminals. That's talking about entire nationalities.
Yeah. So the fact that this country is back in similar space again in 2019, you know, suggests that everything old is new again. I mean, what should be our takeaway here?
Well, my takeaway, my hopeful takeaway, is that the fever always breaks. And it certainly, it took a long time. The anti-immigrant law that was passed in 1924, this incredibly extreme law, in fact, was in place for 41 years. But when it went away, the Statue of Liberty's arms were truly open again and have been for nearly half a century after that. So I am hopeful that we will get past this when there is somebody a little bit less, well, I guess I have to say demagogic, who is pushing a particular point of view.
When this 24 law passed, the New York Times had a famous headline that you quote in the book. That headline read what?
If it's the headline I'm thinking of, America's melting pot comes to an end. And it was an 8-column headline on the passage of this law, an article written by its co-author, Senator David Reed of Pennsylvania. And they were bragging that the melting pot was over, 1924.
Wow. Daniel Okrent, again, his new book, The Guarded Gate, Bigotry, Eugenics, and the Law That Kept Two Generations of Jews, Italians, and Other European Immigrants Out of America. Hey, what a great conversation, Daniel. I sure appreciate the insight.
This has been my pleasure, Steve. Thanks
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you. You bet. Friday on the show, we were live and on site at the Nelson Atkins Museum's Walking Wall, which is right now sitting across and on top of Rock Hill Road. Hear my conversation with the artist behind it at kcur.org/up-to-date. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurup-to-date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, historian and journalist Rick Atkinson shares the stories of ordinary men and women caught in the middle of America's Revolutionary War. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.